Good afternoon and welcome to One More Thing, featuring authors, artists, and entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Donna Lynn, and I'm so happy you could be with me today. My guest has been called a walking encyclopedia of all things show business. Writer, producer, comedian, and Hollywood historian, Jeffrey Mark is one of the most eclectic people I know. The author of Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald and the Lucy book, among others, Jeffrey joins me right now from Los Angeles. Welcome to the show, Jeffrey.
Wow, he sounds great. I can't wait to hear what he has to say.
I want to know him. And speaking of that, we've known each other for quite some time, haven't we?
We have, absolutely.
Yep. And we've been wanting to do this for a while. We're going to be telling stories today about the people you write about, but we're also going to be telling your story, Jeffrey, because it's very unique. So fasten your seatbelts, everyone. I want to start out by saying, and I have to start out by saying, I just love your book on Ella Fitzgerald, published in 2018. It is beautifully done and presented, including a double CD, very generous of you, lots of gorgeous pictures of Ella, and I want everyone to check this out on Amazon.com or call your favorite bookstore. It's very, very worthwhile and entertaining reading. So congrats on that, Jeffrey. Beautifully done.
Well, thank you. And if you want an autographed copy, contact me on Facebook and I'll sell you one myself. Hey, I'll sweep the floor. I'll build the sets. I'm not proud.
Well, you know, you dedicate this book to Ella. And music matters to all of us, and it matters especially to you. How did Ella's music touch and enrich your own life, Jeffrey?
It's a funny thing in that you mentioned my being this encyclopedia of pop culture. So I knew an awful lot about an awful lot of people. But for some reason, growing up in New York City and in Randallstown, Maryland, I just didn't know who she was. Oh, I'd heard the name. I knew she was an African-American singer. But I couldn't tell you what she did outside of a Tisket a Tasket. And I was sitting in Manhattan in the 1970s with a dear friend of mine, David Little, who was a wonderful cabaret singer in New York. And we were watching an episode of Dinah Exclamation Point, a musical variety talk show Dinah Shore hosted. And she was saluting first ladies. And she had Lucille Ball, First Lady of Television, Elizabeth Taylor of Films, Beverly Sills of Opera, and Ella Fitzgerald of Music. And Ella sang with her trio, "I'm Beginning to See the Light," in a song I sing to this day called "Ordinary Fool." And I said out loud, "How long has this been going on?" Because she seemed to sing out of a place I didn't quite understand. She wasn't keeping with the melody, but she was enhancing the melody. She wasn't keeping with the time signature, but she was enhancing it. And it seemed like every note that came out of her mouth was extemporaneously created right that moment by Ella Fitzgerald. And it's a funny thing, again, that you asked that question. There used to be a wonderful, wonderful bookstore, not a bookstore, a record store, in Manhattan called The Colony. And if you wanted an out-of-print record, if you wanted to know the history of anybody, you went to Colony and you hung out and you went through their bins and you learned. And I went there and was guided through Ella's history. And I was fascinated and I was hooked. And once I began to study her music and go see her perform live, it completely changed how I thought about my own performing, my own singing, and how to relate to audiences. So it changed everything for me.
And so that was actually the first time you heard her then on the Dinah Shore show?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of concerts, you saw her how many times in concert, Jeffrey, in your life?
Oh, gosh, 20 or 30 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Every time she was performing anywhere near New York or anywhere near Los Angeles, or anywhere near Baltimore, I would go see her. Towards the end of her life, you know, a little side story. One of the amazing things about Ella's music, when someone like Barbra Streisand or Tony Bennett or Frank Sinatra went out on a tour, they would choose 12 songs, let's say, and it was the Frank Sinatra Sings New York, New York tour. And it would be the same 12 or 14 songs until the tour was over. Ella never did that. Ella had about 300 songs for which she had arrangements. And every night, depending upon how she felt, she chose what she felt like singing that night. So you could go to even an early evening and a late night performance of Ella in the same place, and the songs could be different. Well, towards the end of her life, after diabetes was really kicking her behind and she had a quintuple heart bypass, she started singing the same songs over and over and over again. So I went in and made song lists for Ella of things that I knew she could still handle vocally that would be different enough. And you had to also concern yourself, would she remember the lyrics, because she was getting old and sick. But I did this for a couple of years at the end of her career. So I became incredibly familiar with her canon and how she put a show together, because at the end, I was the guy doing it.
Well, watching Ella perform, and I've been doing a lot of that lately, not just because I'm working on this project with you, but I love her as well. It's like dessert to me. It's a real treat. And every time I see her, I have to call my husband in to watch our large television and say, look at this. And she's having a great time. The audience is having a great time. And she had a real relationship with her audience, didn't she, Jeffrey?
She lived for them. The only place I think, if I can be a little philosophical with you, that I think Ella felt completely at home was when she was on a stage in front of an audience. Even her son said that Ella would take a little bit of time off. She would come home for a week or 10 days or 2 weeks to rest. But after a day or two or five, she'd be chomping at the bit to get back out there. Mm-hmm. So I think it for her was like welcome home. The applause and the energy. Ella, I don't think she had the vocabulary for this. I don't know that she completely intellectually understood it. But Ella and the audience exchanged energies. So she was energized and affected by them as much as they were by her.
Mm-hmm. And it's almost like she needed that little extra, excuse me, pat on the back from the audience in her life.
Well, she needed acceptance. You've read the book. You know her beginnings. Never knowing her real father, her mother dying early in her teens, being raped by her stepfather, being sent to a school for wayward girls where she was tortured, living on the streets of Harlem, living in a bordello, does not do a whole lot to make one feel accepted or wanted or loved.
Right.
I think the audiences did that for her very much in her own heart, in her own soul, and then in ours. Someone said to me once, and it's in the book, I think it was Billy Stritch, was talking to me about Ella, and he said the difference between Ella and someone like Judy Garland, who also lived off the audiences, is that when Judy sang a sad ballad about lost love, you felt her pain. When Ella sang a ballad sad about lost love, you felt your pain.
Mm-hmm.
And both are wonderful and both are amazing, but they're very, very different experiences.
Yes. You know, what's astounding to me and remains that way out of everything I know about Ella is her work ethic. I don't think I've ever seen anything like it. And you have a quote in your book that she said, when the voice is hopping, ain't no need in stopping. And I think that's a great way to sum up Ella.
I don't think I know anyone who had her work ethic. In her day, meaning before she got so sick that she couldn't do this, so from the late 1930s until the late 1980s, which is a 50-year span, Ella was on the road performing in the United States, in Canada, in Mexico, in the Caribbean, in South America, all over Europe and in Asia, something like 42 weeks a year. two shows a night, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week.
Yeah, and who does that? How can you keep up with that? That's so difficult.
Plus, she was making films, appearing on radio, appearing on television, and recording and recording and recording. It is an astonishing thing. From 1956 to 1960, just that four-year period, Ella made live albums and studio albums, 27 albums in 4 years. People take 4 years to make one album now. It's an amazing thing. She never sat still. She never stopped.
How many albums did she have in her lifetime?
They're impossible to count because for the first almost 20 years of her life, they were recorded at 78 RPM records. So Ella's original recording company, Decca, never actually made LPs of one stripe. They would have her record two songs at a time, sometimes four or six if they liked the arranger. But they wouldn't be released together. Later on, they might have been put on an LP, but they weren't made to be released as one of a kind. So it's hard to, you have to sit down and add up, all right, if there's, you know, seven or eight or nine songs, an album, you have to chop up 20 years of work. But from 1956 forward, it's way over 100 albums.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a body of work I don't think anyone will ever again even come close to, because nobody records like that anymore.
Mm-hmm, correct. When you worked with her the latter part of her life there, what was she like to be around and to work with, Jeffrey?
She was terribly shy, terribly aware that her education did not give her a very good vocabulary. It's one of the reasons why she detested being interviewed, because she had trouble coming up with the words.
Mm-hmm.
She had built for herself, or through public relations people, such nonsense about her beginnings that were nowhere near close to the actual truth. And the same was true of her private life. She kept her private life very private. She was terrified of saying something that would reveal something to the public she did not want. Most Ella Fitzgerald fans think of her as a wind-up toy. You wind her up, she sings this incredible concert, she creates this music nobody else can, and then you put it back on a shelf till the next time you want to hear her, not thinking that, you know, she caught colds and got stomach flus and had love affairs and had relatives and friends, and because there was precious little time for that.
Ella
did not like talking about her private life.
Mm-hmm.
Not until the end. Once she retired completely, and she retired only when finally her health just made it impossible for her to be on a stage. Even after her legs were amputated at the ankle, she wanted to keep going in a wheelchair, and her doctor said, no, it's over. Only then, the last few years of her life, she'd have a select few people over in her garden. Her eyesight was practically all gone, and her hearing was almost all gone too. Another reason she couldn't sing anymore, she couldn't hear the music. But she told stories. That's when she told the stories of the glories of her career and her love affairs to a very select few that she trusted.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the new projects that you have is your podcast, Jeffrey Mark Plays Ella. Tell us about that and how we can tune in.
Well, for years, people have been saying, you need to turn this thing into music. You can't just write about her. It's one of the reasons why I was so thrilled that we were able to put the two CDs in with the book. If I could take one just side leg, because one will lead to the other. I was doing a show at the Grammy Museum with Patty Austin in Salute to Ella. And there were people from Universal Music. It turns out that Universal Music is the parent company now for all of the various companies for whom Ella recorded through the years, all under one roof. So I said, you know, it would be wonderful for the book if we could include some of the music. And I have, through the years, done work with her various recording companies, reissues, writing album notes, choosing songs, sequencing them for them. And I said, could we use one of those in the book? You know, something that already has my name on it. And they thought it was a great idea, but they said it costs us the same whether you use something we've already done or something brand new. Why don't you do something brand new so that you're not competing with yourself on the market? So we have two CDs in the book. One is the very best of her studio work from the 30s till she died, sequenced the way Ella would have. The other one is live concerts, sequenced the way she would have. Mm-hmm. And people said, you did so well at this, and you've been nominated for a Grammy Award for doing this kind of work. Why don't you make a radio show out of it? So Jeffrey Mark Plays Ella, or we call it GPE. Every week, I choose a theme. Like, the very first show we did was Ella and Cole Porter. And we chose music from the Cole Porter songbook, from a 1970s album she did with Nelson Riddle of Cole Porter music, from live concerts through the years, from other albums where she happened to sing a song. And I talk about how the music was made, what was going on in Ella's life, what might have been funny or tragic while it was going on. And people are seeming to love it. I'm very, very gratified. So we've got 10 of them already made. Number 11 is going to be Ella and Oscar Peterson. We're recording that this coming week. And people can find it on Apple Tunes and all sorts of, almost every good platform that plays music is carrying the show. And I'm very, very, very grateful. And thank you for asking.
Yes, that's thrilling. I want to go back to her early days. I couldn't help myself, Jeffrey, coming up with so many questions about Ella because she's so interesting and provocative and just great fodder for conversation. Take us back to how she actually broke into singing, because my understanding is that she wanted to be a dancer at first.
Well, Ella found herself, after running away from the children's home that was more or less a prison for her, found herself living on the streets of Harlem. She became a numbers runner. For those of you who don't know what that means, it means back in the days when gambling was completely illegal in New York City. You'd choose a number, and if your number that you chose came up, you won money for that. And they would have young people picking up the money and picking up the numbers, and you bet like $1 or $2 on this. So Ella did that. And Ella was a lookout at a house of prostitution. She was so young. She was, you know, not just young, but she had a baby face, so she looked even much younger than she was. And she would sit in the window, and if she saw someone coming who she thought might be a cop, all the ladies put on a dress and started knitting. So if they got raided, all they were able to be a knitting circle. And she wanted to be a dancer. She wanted to call herself Snake Hips Fitzgerald. And there was an amateur hour in Harlem, and Ella put in her name and the phone number of the House of Prostitution should they want to contact her. Well, they called. They said, it's your turn. Come in. And four of the girls from the house, four of the sex workers, went with her. And the very, very last act on the bill was the Edwards Sisters, which was a flash act. Just incredible hard dancing done very, very, very quickly to almost take your breath away. And Ella saw that, and then her name was called. And she said, I can't follow that with my dancing. And the girls literally pushed her out on stage. And as I say in the book, if a spotlight hit her for the first time, and we're never going to know who was happier, Ella to have the spotlight or the spotlight to have Ella. And she walked over to the band leader, and he said, you know, honey, you got to do something. Can you sing? And, you know, she said, you know the song Judy? I know Connie Boswell's version of Judy. And he said, hey, we got that arrangement. Because in those days, the bands would have copied arrangements of popular songs off of the radio. And she sang Judy, and she won. And that was it. She won and she won and she won and she won. In a very short period of time, Bardu Ali, who was the front man for the Chick Webb Orchestra, because Chip couldn't stand in front of his band. He was the drummer. Bardu did. he saw Ella and brought her to Chick backstage. And Ella was dirty, unkempt, torn dress, her hair a mess. She literally did not know how to present herself as a female. No one had ever taught her even the rudiments of female cleanliness. Well, Chick had a couple of gay men in his band. They taught her. They coiffed her. They took her shopping for clothes. They taught her how to put on makeup. And they tried Ella out at Yale. And the Yaleys loved her. And that was it. She was a member of Chick Webb's band. And eventually, and when I say eventually, in very short time, went from being, you know, vocalist without a name to being his partner in the act. You know, Chick Webb and vocalist. Chick Webb with Ella Fitzgerald in tiny little letters. Chick Webb and Ella Fitzgerald in, you know, even letters. And when Chick passed away, Ella took over the orchestra. By this point, she went from being criminal, gamin, dirty, unwashed, unkempt girl to being one of the top vocalists in this country in just a couple of years. It was a meteoric rise for anyone. But for an African-American woman, it was unheard of back then.
I want to just
because
go back
to... she didn't do it at MGM like Lena Horne did it. She did it strictly by records and appearing in ballrooms with the band singing and being on the radio.
At the Apollo Theater, when she decided she wasn't going to dance that night, did she have any idea at all, or did anybody have any idea that she could sing like that, Jeffrey?
No, she had done some singing, both in school, public school, a little bit of public school she attended. They made her sing at the girls' school, but she had no idea of style. She knew she could carry a tune. And of course, like all of us who sing, we are influenced by the people who came before. So there were both African-American and other ethnicities of singers who Ella listened to. I think she said Connie Boswell was the biggest influence on her. So she knew what she liked to hear. Mm-hmm. Ella always said, "I sing from my heart. I sing the way I feel something." And she began to sing what she felt. She was also, although not schooled, wise. And in the beginning, she would sit with the Webb band with little file cards and write down everything she was learning. She never wanted to be left behind. She never wanted the men in the band to feel that she was anything less than a blessing to them. So she watched and listened and learned and took notes and rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed to develop a style. And with success came confidence, and with confidence came more risks vocally. And the more she did, the more she succeeded, and the more she succeeded, the more she did.
And, you know, when you listen to her, like when you first listened to her on the Donna Shore Show, it's addictive because she's so versatile and so sweet sounding when she sings the jazz, yet sultry when she sings the ballads.
Even into the 1960s, she was very much influenced by the new music. She loved the Beatles. She was the first person to record a cover version of one of their songs, and she made the top 40 with it, with Can't Buy Me Love. She loved Aretha Franklin and began to mimic Aretha a little bit. She began to sing soul music in her concerts, and it was a phase. She phased it out, but the audiences loved it in the moment. So she was always learning. Ella was still trying to get better. I think really only health kept her from improving and improving. There just came a point in her life where the range of her voice diminished, where her vibrato became a little wobbly. She began to lose lyrics a little too often. And then finally, she couldn't stand up anymore. But up till that point, So let's say from 1935 until 1987, 88, it was a constant learning curve. Always something new, something different. She wanted to expand. Mm-hmm. Perhaps that's why she was popular so long. It wasn't the same old thing year after year.
Yeah, she seemed like she was a real life learner, as they say today. Now, she played with, went on to play with some of the biggest, Sinatra and Benny Goodman, Dizzy Gillespie. Who do you think were the most instrumental people in her career who pushed her forward?
Well, certainly Chick Webb. We have to give a huge salute to him. It had to have been a little bit of an ego bump to realize that people were seeing his band as much for Ella as for him. But he didn't let that stop him. He let her shine. Certainly during the war years of World War II, when she toured with Dizzy Gillespie, Ella gave Dizzy a huge nod that her scatting, her good scatting, came out of watching Dizzy work, and that she learned right at his knee on how to do that kind of thing. I think Duke Ellington and Count Basie both, because she sang with both orchestras a lot. Mm-hmm. I think watching their extraordinarily talented musicians and the two men themselves. Louis Armstrong was a big influence. Ella didn't sing like Louis, but they recorded sides for Decca, the 78s. They recorded two LP records for Norman Granz in the late 50s, and they did a wonderful two-version person of Porgy and Bess together. You have to pick something up from that. And they were like brother and sister. They were going to the recording studio, and Louis wanted Ella to sound girlish and lively, and he would just say, just whisper filth into her ear right before they said, you know, go, and she'd be almost laughing as she started, because he knew you'd hear it in the recording. See, Louis helped her. It's one thing to sing well, and it's one thing to sing well in front of an audience. It's a different set of muscles in a recording studio. There's an intimacy mm-hmm. that is necessary, and I think Louis helped her with the intimacy.
I think one of the songs I love with her and Louis is Can't We Be Friends. Do you remember that song?
My favorite.
That's my favorite too.
It is my favorite of everything they did together. Oscar Peterson's playing and Ray Brown on bass, because Ella had been married to him for a while. It was just a perfect marriage of a song, two singers having a ball. And although there were no arrangements, literally, they went into the studio and used what jazz musicians call head arrangements, meaning there's nothing written down. They talk it out. Well, you do four bars of this, and I'll do two bars of that, and we'll change the key here. Okay, go. Mm-hmm. It worked. It worked brilliantly. It is still a go-to of mine when I want to relax or if I'm going to dust the house. Can't We Be Friends gets me smiling and moving.
Yes. What kind of an impact do you think Ella's music has left on our culture, Jeffrey?
I don't think there is a singer working today, meaning if there are people in their 90s still working, down to the veriest youngest of young people, who may be teenagers right now, who haven't been influenced by Ella. Mm-hmm. They may not know they've been influenced by her, but they've been influenced by people who have been influenced by her. I listen to young people sing pop. I don't mean hip-hop people, because that wasn't Ella's thing at all. But I mean people who actually sing a melody to whatever. And you hear how they approach the song. You would listen to the vibrato in their voice. You listen to how they bend notes or, And yeah, that's a very popular thing, but Ella started that. And she did it better, by the way. So everybody, she's an influence on everybody. Anyone who has an ear, who actually has talent, takes from Ella Fitzgerald.
Good point. You know, we could talk two more hours about Ella, but I want to get your story in here too, Jeffrey. Like Ella, you had a little bit of a rough beginning. You were born in New York, but you say you were raised everywhere. Could you explain that?
Sure. And those of you who are faint of heart, fasten your seatbelts.
Exactly.
I wish I could clean this up, or I wish I could sanitize this to make it sound nice. It just isn't. I will never, ever know why my parents got married. My father was an alcoholic, drug-addicted child molester. My mother was a codependent narcissist. Why they thought they needed to try to have babies as teenagers, I don't know. Possibly to try to prove that my father wasn't gay. So it gets very complicated. I was born. I almost didn't live. I was a premature baby due to my mother's toxemia. And it was a very rough growing up for me. Thank God for my maternal grandparents who, to the best they could, kept me from harm. I was born in Brooklyn, and that's what I think of as home, really. But we moved a lot because my father either had to run away from a bad situation he created, or just over there is going to be better for us. My problems won't follow me over there. He thought changing your geography left your problems behind, which is, of course, nonsense. So we ended up, after going around the country a lot, in a suburb of Baltimore called Randallstown. Yes, I was sexually abused. Yes, I was tortured. Yes, things were very bad. I don't go into details because what's the point of these specific details? I think that tells anyone anything they need to know. If you're looking for a lurid tale, my autobiography is coming out next year. You can read that there. But just know that it was terribly, terribly unhappy for me. I knew from the time I was two that show business was going to be it for me. I was on the stage amateur at four. I was gone after by studios when I was eight. My parents turned everything down until they no longer had any control. By the time we got to Randallstown, my parents were hardly parents anymore. They were so busy taking care of my father's drug addiction and trying to pretend like nothing was wrong, that I was on my own. In fact, there were periods there towards the end of my high school life where they would just disappear. I wouldn't even know where they were. I was at home, but they weren't there. But happily for me, in Randallstown, which is why I call Randallstown my second home, I went to Randallstown High School, and on my first day of high school, I was not yet 14, I met two people, really, who changed my life completely. A woman, the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. Her name today is Phyllis Viana. We are still brother and sister all these years later. And the man who would own my heart for the rest of my life, Joel Kabik. We met in a musical theater class on my first day. And I know this sounds silly, and if it offends anyone, I'm sorry. I don't apologize for my life. If you don't like it, you know, turn the channel. Joel and I fell in love instantly, and although we never lived together, we were a couple for 47 years. So Phyllis and Joel took me out of amateur show business and put me into professional show business. Mm-hmm. And I did my first dinner theater show at 15, my first movie at 16, my first off-Broadway show at 17, and here we are all these years later talking about me, so I guess I did something right.
Yeah. Well, you were one of those kids that watched TV like me. I love TV, Lucy and all the shows. What were some of the first TV programs that really grabbed you, Jeffrey?
My mother always said that I learned to talk by watching I Love Lucy, because when Lucy spoke, she thought that I thought that Lucy was speaking directly to me, so I spoke back to her. That's her story. I kind of believe it. I loved the sitcoms, and I loved the game shows, and I loved the variety shows. I think I Love Lucy is the biggest influence. The Ed Sullivan Show was an enormous influence, allowing me to see a cornucopia. Ed Sullivan, in those days, for those of you who don't remember who this is, presented video vaudeville. In an hour, he would have jugglers and dancers and singers and comedians and dog acts paced like an old-time live vaudeville show. And you could see Barbra Streisand, Ethel Merman, Judy Garland, Zero Mostel. You could see Frank Sinatra. You could see Ella Fitzgerald. The best of the best of every genre of show business was on this show. Huge influence to me. And then there was the game show To Tell the Truth. And that one is more personal. The panel, when it finally settled down after a number of years of being on the show, were four celebrities faced against three people, all claiming to be the same person. Only one was sworn to tell the truth. The other two were imposters. And Tom Poston, Peggy Cass, Orson Bean, and Kitty Carlisle were the ones I remembered best. And my grandmother used to use the show because she thought Kitty Carlisle was the best woman who'd ever lived. The most glamorous, the most feminine, the most empowered, the best clothing, the best manners. And my mother would say to him, "Mommy, leave him alone. What does he need with Kitty Carlisle?" And my grandmother said, "You don't even know what's in your son. These are the people he's going to be living with when he grows up. He needs to know how to interact with them." And they fought over it. And my grandmother said, "Someday he's going to be in Kitty Carlisle's living room telling how you didn't believe this and laughing at you." Well, about 44 years later, I was in Kitty Carlisle Hart's living room telling the story. My grandmother had already passed. Mrs. Hart was in her 90s. And we didn't laugh. We cried. But my grandmother was right. I ended up in her living room at her request. I didn't make it happen. Mm-hmm. I was back east in a suite in a hotel promoting my Ethel Merman book. And Mrs. Hart called and said, "Could you please come by with a copy of that wonderful book?" I don't know, but I didn't jump out the window and fly to her Fifth Avenue apartment.
And that because sounds just like her, too. That sounds just like her.
But it was an amazing thing to watch her take a singing lesson in front of me and then talk about my grandmother with her. So that's a huge influence on me. But I think practically everything that was on television in the 1950s and 60s and 70s influenced me in some way. I'm a sponge. If I sense something is good, either the writing or the talent or the acting or the singing, I just absorb it and use it in my own life somehow.
You've done so many things in different genres and entertainment. What brings you the most joy these days, Jeffrey?
Well, for somebody who likes to sell books, I'll be honest with you. The thing that brings me the most joy, it's not the writing of books, although I love doing it, and I'm grateful I've been so successful at it. It's not doing stand-up comedy, although I love making people laugh. But personal joy is being in front of an audience and singing. Mm-hmm. Singing jazz in front of an audience or singing Broadway songs, that's where like my soul is completely satisfied.
Can you sing a little number for us today?
Oh, goodness gracious. We'll see if the microphone will pick this up. Yes. Let me pull up. Would you like to hear something up-tempo or something, a ballad? What would you like to hear? You get to pick the genre. I'll pick the song.
Oh, I do. How about something up-tempo?
All righty. This is a Marty Paich arrangement. I will make the music as loud as I can because we're not plugged in here. But hopefully you'll be able to hear the music in the background, and hopefully you'll be able to hear my voice. This is the happy song. I love the arrangement, and I love that I get to do something a little different with it. An old gal maid has got to shake it on Sweet Georgia Brown. Two left feet, but oh, so lit. has sweet Georgia Brown. They all sighed, wanna cry for sweet Georgia Brown. I dare you just lie. You know I don't lie, not much. Cause it's been said that she an oxen dead when she lands in town. What a shame, what a shame. How she cougars them down. The feller she can't get, the feller she ain't met. Georgia name, the Georgia claim, her sweet Georgia Brown. No gal mate has got a heart of shade on a sweet Georgia Brown. To be like a feet, Tony, has Georgia Brown. They all sigh and wanna cry for that Georgia Brown. I'll tell you just why. You know I don't lie. Not much, cause it's been said she knocks him dead when she lands, when she lands, when she lands in town. What a shame, what a shame. How she cools them down. The fellers she can't get, all the fellers she ain't met. Georgia named the Georgia claimed her sweet Georgia Brown. No gal, not one gal's got a shade on Georgia Brown. Do think Sony, hey, that Georgia Brown. They all sigh and wanna cry for that Georgia Brown. Listen what I tell ya. You know, you know, you know, you know, you know I don't lie. All the tips, the porter slipped to sweet Georgia Brown. They all pay for fashion shows with $1 down. Fellas, she can't get other fellas. She ain't met well, oh boy. She's the cat feed, oh joy. She's the cat, she's no gal. Got a shade on sweet. She's got the left feet. But so neat. She got money and clothes and diamonds too. There's just nothing that gal can't do. She's got the guys all hanging around. How she really the cougars them down. Georgia named her, Georgia claimed her. Sweet Georgia Brown. Georgia named her, Georgia claimed her. That old gal's called Georgia Brown. Pow!
Wow.
Was that good for you?
Wow, you got me rocking over here. Good job, Jeffrey. Great voice.
Thank you.
Beautifully done. I love that. Yeah, I'm rocking over here. Nobody can see me, but... Well, my goodness, where do we go from here?
Well, you asked for it.
You admire ambitious people, and Ella certainly was very ambitious. And another ambitious person that we both love is our dearie Lucille Ball, who could just do about anything professionally. Your book is very entertaining. It's called The Lucy Book. And I enjoyed reading the quotes from Lucy and Madeline Pugh. I always wanted to interview Madeline, one of the writers of the show. Just a great writer.
Between you and me and our friends who are listening, next year, next summer around this time, we'll be premiering the new Lucy book, which is, you know, the original one was her television work. Nothing about her personal life, but all about the work. This new one, besides having new interviews with Carol Burnett and Ann Margaret and Barbara Eden and Rich Little and a new foreword by Fran Drescher, it will also include all the radio shows and films. So we have that to look forward to late next summer.
And that's late 2022. What is your opinion on why Lucy has such... lastability after over 70 years?
same combination of things that a lot of the people I write about have. First, God-given talent. That's the basic. Secondly, and you just mentioned it a moment ago, ambition. Lucille Ball was a very ambitious person. She worked ridiculously hard. She didn't take it easy. Her work was her life. And I admire that. That's how I feel about my work, too. Thirdly, that although we loved her first 15, 20 years of work, it's the television shows we really remember her for, because they were up against the wall with I Love Lucy, trying to figure out how to please everybody. And Desi Arnaz asked, well, why can't we film this show in front of a live audience? So you got Lucille Ball at her best. So she's 40 years old. She's made 70 films. She's had a hit radio show. She's at her peak. And they get to do it in front of an audience on film so that decade after decade after decade, everybody gets to watch the show. Everybody falls in love. And then she has 23 years of that that gets rerun over and over and over again. So it's hard work, incredible God-given talent, motivation and ambition beyond measure, and the luck of having it on film so we could watch it over and over again. There are a lot of people in show business who are wonderful on the stage, but didn't do a lot of television. Young people today have no idea who they are. Or live television, where it's lost or it's hard to watch because it's old and grainy and black and white. Lucy is digitally remastered and right there for you.
You know, when I've interviewed a lot of people on the life of Lucy over the years, over the last 30 years, and read a lot about her. I've done a lot of editing when I put shows together. And one word I always come up with, and I really mean this as a compliment, sort of like Ella Fitzgerald, workhorse comes to mind, because Lucy would do anything she was told. She took all those pies in the face, and she wasn't a glamour girl. You know, a lot of people, a lot of young actresses wouldn't have done that. But Lucy did everything she was told to do. Pretty remarkable.
She knew she needed, like Ella, she knew she needed to learn. She knew she needed to grow. She knew that she wanted this to be a career and not just a money machine. She had lots of motivation because she was supporting relatives, so she needed to make a lot of money, but she wanted to be excellent. And we said this about Ella earlier in the hour. The more Miss Ball did, the better she got, the more she did. She was doing radio in the 1930s, learning how to do that. So by the late 1940s, she gets a big hit radio sitcom. Well, she had that 10 years of learning how to do it right. She was a chorus girl in films before she was a star in films. She learned everything. And to her credit, she learned lighting. She learned sound. She learned direction. So when all of a sudden it's her show, it's I Love Lucy, and eventually she owns the cameras because it's Desi Lu, she knows what she's doing. You know, there are people out there who are very big when they're very young, and they don't grow beyond it. They're one or two or three hit wonders, or their career lasts 5 years.
We're getting low on time here. I do want to mention all of your books. I urge you to look up his books, Jeffrey Mark's books, on Amazon.com, or just call your favorite bookstore, or you can contact Jeffrey on Facebook. Jeffrey, thank you so much. Great, great conversation today. Not only about yourself, but some of your favorite people. I hope that you'll come back and visit us again, will you?
As often as you ask me, and I'll sing a ballad next time.
One last thing I'd like you to say is, how would you like to sum this up today?
Sum up our visit?
Yes, our visit. What would you, one last thing to say today to our listeners about anything?
I think it's, I know I have something. I think it's very important. If you love show business, if show business is a hobby or a passion, or you think you have some talent, do as much as you can right where you live and study, study, study. Study the great people with the great talent. There's something to learn from all of them. Whether you buy my books or you go to museums and watch old movies or old TV, but learn. There's a whole industry out there that can be a university education for you just by watching and observing and listening to shows like this. Well, you will learn things that
yeah,
will help you.
I think that's about the best advice I've ever heard. Thank you so much. And I'll see all of you. Thank you.
You finally did it. Yay.
Yay. Yes. Yes. Thank you again, Jeffrey. And I'll see all of you next time on One More Thing. Bye for now.